Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are many places where history is preserved. One of them is the State Archives of North Carolina. Though North Carolina became an official colony in 1712 after splitting from South Carolina, and then the 12th state in the Union in 1789, keeping official historical records came much later. In 1900, the North Carolina Historical Commission was created and charged with collecting and publishing records and historical materials. That role was expanded in 1935 and then in 2012. This repository officially became the Division of Archives and Records, or the State Archives of North Carolina. So what do they do? What's in the archives? What is not? And who makes the decisions about collecting and storing our history? For answers, we turn to Kelly Policelli. She is the State Archivist of North Carolina, and she joins us for the hour. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
You're welcome. You became the State Archivist, as I understand it, just in December. You took over for Sarah Kuntz, who was there since, I think, 2012. Did she have any words of wisdom to you as she handed you the keys?
You know, she has been extremely gracious in helping me with this transition. And that's what she told me, is to give myself grace to get to know everything that I need to know. I'm not new to the State Archives, though. I worked here for many years in various different capacities. So I've been a digital archivist. I was a records management analyst and appraisal archivist. And I was the head of the description unit for government records. So I've been around the block. I kind of know at least some of what happens around here, but it is a learning curve. So I am still deep in it.
I was going to ask you how one becomes an archivist. I would think that you're a rare breed. There aren't many of you out there.
Actually, you know, these days, archives have become professionalized and are sort of parallel to librarianship. So a lot of archivists these days have library science degrees. And especially in North Carolina, we've got a lot of great library science programs. So it ends up being a choice that you make when you're in that kind of program. But then also, we have a wonderful public history program at NC State that I attended that prepares folks for some of the more challenging parts of, you know, archives and museums and working with the public and helping to advocate for public history and that kind of stuff. So there are a few different avenues. There are folks who come straight from history programs and then learn about the archives sciences later. So there are a lot of different ways to get to where I am.
You have been a researcher. You've been a digital archivist. And we're going to talk about digital archives a little bit later on. You've been the coordinator of Elon University's archives and special collections. What exactly does an archivist do? And now that you're not exactly in the trenches every day, hands-on with individual materials, because you're running the whole thing, how would you describe your job?
You know, I think this is one of the big misconceptions about archives. It's hard for people to imagine what it is we do all day, but we are working constantly to do the work of the archives, which involves working with folks outside of the archives to give them advice on how to keep their records as they're creating things that have historical value, doing pickups and appraisals so that folks know the value of the material that they have. Within the archives right now, in our buildings total, we probably have about 180,000 cubic feet of material. Most of that is considered unprocessed, meaning we have looked at it, we have determined that it's archival, but we have not gone through and rehoused it into boxes and folders that are acid-free so that we can sort of That helps to preserve the materials. You know,
Yeah.
all of the things in this world chemically decline over time, they deteriorate. And in order to make sure that we can hang on to this stuff, we have to make sure that we're putting it in the right environment, but also making sure that the housing that it's in isn't exacerbating that deterioration. We have folks who are digitizing materials all the time. Because we have so much material, there's really a very small percentage that at this point has been posted online. But we're always adding to those collections because we know how useful that is. When folks can't get to Raleigh, they can still see some of the most valuable and most historically relevant material that we have. We have folks whose whole job it is to answer questions, to provide reference and access. And to do research for people who cannot make it to Raleigh. We charge a very small fee for that. But if you have a question and you can't make it out here to check out the records yourself, we can do some of that research for you. We have a whole microfilm unit that moves material to microfilm. It saves space. Microfilm is an incredibly stable format for materials. We have folks who do the conservation work. That tends to be some of the stuff that people are most interested in. They are using different chemical processes to restore and or stabilize material. They're encapsulating it in sleeves that help to maintain access so that you can actually handle the material without damaging it with oils from your skin and that kind of thing. And then we have the management part, the outreach part, and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot that goes into running an archive.
So you've got all these things going on. This is a never-ending job because even as you're doing all of what you just talked about, every day, new documents, new photos, new
Yes.
records of every sort are being produced. And every day, I would imagine, they're coming into you over time. What criteria do you use to decide whether this document that you were just handed, this photo that you were just handed, this recording that you were just handed, what criteria do you use to decide, yeah, that belongs in our archive, or nah, not so much?
For us, a lot of it comes down to significance, like statewide significance. Does this provide information or evidence about something that we know has been going on in North Carolina or was going on in North Carolina at one time or another? Does it document an event or an action or a decision that was made? We focus mainly on government records here in the archives. We do also have a special collection. On the government records side, it really is about rights and responsibilities, things that the government has promised to do, decisions that government officials have made. That kind of thing. On the special collection side, it tends to be, what are the stories in North Carolina that government records can't tell? Sometimes that's how the government decisions have actually affected people on the ground. Sometimes that has to do with organizations, grassroots organizations here in North Carolina that are doing work on various issues.
But it
So
seems
it
that
runs the gamut.
I was going to say it seems that sometimes the historical value of something reveals itself over time. It may not appear to be much right now, but later on you turn around and think, oh, that was the pivotal moment. That was the thing that
Yeah.
made such and such happen. Do things slip through the cracks because you thought at the time it wasn't significant, but it turns out to be?
I think because this is a human endeavor, there are always things like that that happen. There are materials that slip through the cracks, and the fact is that archives reflect what the people who are involved value. So this is a real problem when we think about the way folks thought about history, especially in the early 20th century when archives were starting to be developed in the South. There was a very big focus on sort of great men, the powerful, and ended up being much more focused on wealthy white individuals who were at the top of the game in industry, in politics, and other aspects of society. So yes, there in that sense, we know that there are relevant historical things that have not necessarily been documented over time. On the flip side of that, there are instances where we know, something was collected that actually like maybe shouldn't have been, just because there's a better source for that, or there's a more authoritative source for that. So we are always thinking about our choices, looking at our collections, and looking for gaps in our collections. It becomes very difficult because over time things are lost, either because someone didn't realize they were significant, or because of emergency type situations, disasters like fire, floods, hurricanes. So there are a lot of reasons why. It can be human error, it can be human bias, but it also can be just the ravages of time that leave things undocumented.
So, since the beginning of time, libraries and archives have been basically paper-based. The records that we
Yes.
produced as human beings were coming into people on paper. Now, some of them are they live their lives. They're created digitally. They don't necessarily ever end up on a piece of paper. And a lot
Yes.
of the things that you have in your archives, and you're not alone in this, other organizations are doing the same thing. You're digitizing them, which means you're essentially turning them into, I guess, for lack of a better term, PDFs. But anybody who has a computer, anybody who owned a VCR back in the 80s and 90s knows that electronic records and files are subject to constant changes in technology. To be able to play back that old VCR tape, you have to have a player. Same thing is true with computer records because the document forms have changed over time, as have the hardware. It's changed over time. It's constantly changing. So, how do
Yes.
you ensure that what you're storing in digital form will be able to be accessed in 10, 20, 50, 100 years?
Yeah. This is a really good question, and something that I actually wish that more people were thinking about. We have a lot of knowledge about this. A lot of that comes from digital forensics, which is not necessarily part of library science, but has taught us a lot of things about how to maintain and preserve digital records. You're 100% right. One of the things that makes archives so endlessly fascinating to me is the fact that we, as an industry, as a field, we can't leave any format behind. In any other situation, you might switch from this sort of obsolete, piece of software or piece of equipment, and you move on and you let that go and you start with something new. Whereas we need to make sure that we can still play those cassette tapes and VHS tapes and Betamax tapes and all of the other formats that have come in over the years.
Yeah,
One of the
even
ways that we do
even I
that
have
is
to
by
I
digitizing
ho
them.
ho I got to stop you because we're coming up to a break. And
Okay.
we can talk about how you maintain the currency of this, because I know that in broadcasting we used to have tape machines. We don't have any tape machines anymore. So we have these reels of tape that cannot be played because we don't
Yeah.
have the hardware. So we'll talk about that when we come back. Kelly Policelli is our guest. She is the North Carolina State Archivist.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, offering an international curriculum and IB diploma program for high school students designed to help prepare them for college, careers, and a global community. BISCharlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Kelly Policelli is our guest. She is the North Carolina State Archivist. We're talking about the archives that North Carolina has been keeping over most of the 20th century and into the 21st, and we'll get into what's in the archives. But we've been talking about the transition to digital, because so many documents now are digital. They started their lives that way. Others are being digitized from paper form into that digital form, and that causes a problem, because as anybody who has a stanch of photographs knows, or slide decks from the 1960s and 70s, if you don't have a machine to play them back on, they're pretty worthless. So this, what you're talking about now, it could be valuable to ordinary people who have these treasure troves of family films on tape, etc., that they can't play. This may give them a clue about what they have to do to be able to play them in the future.
Absolutely.
So we were talking about maintaining the ability to do that. And you have said that new infrastructure around digital records is needed. Is that what you're talking about there?
That is what I'm talking about. For us, it's a little bit more technical. But, you know, it's true. Most of what you're talking about when you're talking about VHS tapes, reel-to-reel film, other, you know, even at this point, people don't have CD players or, you know, CD-ROMs built into their computers anymore. They can't play those. DVDs are kind of going by the wayside. These substrates is what we would call them, the materials that are holding the data. They don't last forever. They also deteriorate. So it will be a fact that some of those things that people are keeping for posterity will not be playable. There are lots of services out there that can pull that data off and save it in a digital format. But again, like, that's just the first step. Digitization is not preservation.
Yeah, because if you store something on a hard drive and the hard drive sits on a shelf for 5 years, 10 years, it loses information. It needs to be powered up every once in a while. So that, and I guess that might be true with storing them on chips or thumb drives or whatever you store them on. How do they deteriorate faster than paper would have? And how do you prevent that from happening?
Yeah.
How do you make sure it doesn't happen?
So all of those types of external media do deteriorate much faster than paper. Paper can last hundreds of years in the right environmental conditions. You can certainly maintain those kinds of media longer if you've got the right, environmental controls and that kind of thing. Unfortunately, a lot of people put, you know, their valuable historical things in a basement or in an attic. Those are exactly where you don't want to store materials that you are trying to keep for the long term, because most of those spaces don't have the kind of they don't have HVAC. They don't have a constant temperature and a constant humidity. You want to keep your temperature below 70. You want to keep your humidity at about 50%. But even if you do that, a lot of the material, it's not made to last that long. Long term in IT terms tends to be like 5 to 10 years, whereas long term for us is
forever,
for posterity, for in perpetuity. So, you know, when you have material on those kinds of media, you need to migrate it off and onto a new media on a regular basis. I would say every 5 years, that's something that you would need to do. Digitizing things, like I said, is kind of the first step. But then the second step is just maintaining newer equipment, keeping things in formats that are common and are continuously supported. So PDF is great because, you know, PDF is something that we've been investing in for, you know, decades at this point, for things like documents and that kind of thing. It's harder with audio, video, and that kind of stuff because, there are proprietary formats. There are different equipment creates different types of files. Archives, though, we have, you know, a lot more technical work that goes into it. And I can get into that if you want me to, but, you know.
When you digitize a document that in and of itself has value, for instance, I know you don't work for the National Archives, but if you did, and you were going to digitize the original copy of the United States Constitution, which is in the archives, would you then retain the paper copy for posterity?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So you're making double copies of everything,
yes.
or just the most historical documents?
Well, you know, that's so digitization, when you're talking about archival digitization, there's a lot of work that goes into it, because it's not just the copy. There's metadata that goes into it. It gets uploaded with this metadata so that it's, you know, easy to identify where the thing came from. Mm-hmm. Here in the state archives, yes, we keep all of the original material, because that is the original record. And you really can't replace that with a digital copy. There are situations in which we do digitize things like that, because we know that, you know, everything eventually deteriorates. At some point, it may be that the digital copy is easier to read than the original, you know, when you kind of cast yourself into the future. And it also helps us, because for some of the most valuable material, we don't want to have to take it out and have people handling it all the time. So having a digital copy means that we are actually able to preserve the paper a little bit more than we would have been able to if we couldn't provide access to that in a digital format.
But I remember going to the National Archives and looking at the original Declaration of Independence and the original Constitution, and I know I couldn't touch it. It was behind glass and sealed in argon gas, no doubt. So
yes.
It would and protected from light, because light destroys paper documents and the mm-hmm. ink on them. But there's something about seeing them in three dimensions, physically right in front of you. And if you're allowed to touch something like that, there's something about touching it, knowing that your hand is on a piece of paper somebody historically significant handled and wrote on. Do we lose something when that's digitized?
It is. I mean, that's a great question. And I think absolutely we do. We, you know, we have five senses, and we like to use them all. We learn through all of those different inputs. This is one of my huge fears, though, is, you know, as you were saying, right now, historical documents are all being created in digital format only. So 50 years from now, 100 years from now, when people come to the archives, or when they're online looking at archival material, they may be looking at, you know, I hope, a PDF that is 100 years old, and it's not going to be that kind of you know, romantic, emotional, tactile experience that some of our older stuff is now, but it's going to be no less important. So how do we make this shift real for people? Because I see it all the time. People come in, they see something old, and they, you know, they want to touch it. They want to take a look at both sides of it. And it really, you know, it's cool. It's definitely cool. And I'm not sure how we make PDFs cool.
we've already referenced this. Everybody's heard of the National Archives. It's where the documents of the founding of the nation are kept, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, all stored with mm-hmm. billions of other paper records from all three branches of government, military records, photographs, audio, video, etc., and more. What is stored in the North Carolina Archives?
We have a lot of material that's actually related to some of the stuff you were talking about. We have some of the original copies of, you know, North Carolina's copies of those documents. We do have North Carolina's copy of the Bill of Rights. It is not in good condition, unfortunately, because it was out of our custody for a very long time. We have North Carolina's copies of the various amendments to the Constitution. We have a lot of documents from the founding that are from the perspective of our delegates to the Continental Congress, and from some of the folks on the ground here in the committees of safety. We have some colonial records from prior to 1776, our original Constitution. We have from 1776 for North Carolina. It's one of the earliest constitutions. So we have a lot of older things like that. We have the original, we have governor's papers going all the way back to the founding of the state. We have Secretary of State records going back that far, as well as treasurer and comptroller papers, which At the time of our founding, the governor was also the treasurer. So there's a lot of overlap in all of that. And those documents tell a lot of interesting stories because there are records on the ports of North Carolina. There are records on some of our interactions with the tribal nations in the state. We also collect county records. So we have a lot of materials that are super valuable to genealogists especially, but reflect the business of in the various counties. So that would be...
I read this yesterday and it kind of surprised me because you have this large collection of records from all the counties in North Carolina, all 100 counties, dating back to the founding of those counties in many cases. Don't counties keep their own records?
In North Carolina, they do not. Counties are, we schedule their records here. That's one of our functions is we provide records management advice to both local and state government. And we create records retention schedules, which basically tells these various offices what they have to keep for how long, what they can destroy after a certain point, and what comes to the archives. Unlike it's true other in other states, county records can be kept in the county. There might be a county archive here. County records come to Raleigh, where we provide access to them. And the counties can also call us up and get access to their older records.
So, if a genealogist based in Indiana is trying to do work for somebody who wants to know about their ancestors in North Carolina, and they knew they had an ancestor in Wake County or an ancestor in Guilford County or Mecklenburg County, they wouldn't go to the county. They go to you?
They would, yes, they would probably start with us. Now, the thing about our records retention schedules is we can't compel anyone to actually do a transfer. If the counties want to keep their records in the county, that is perfectly allowed. And then they are taking responsibility for managing those records. But the fact is that, you know, county courthouses are not getting any bigger. The records become voluminous and they need some place to store them. So that's where it tends to happen that, you know, a courthouse is moving and they're not going to have as much storage space or they're running out of storage space as it is. And so it's always the older records that come here. Newer records are still with the county usually.
I was told that you just did a large pickup of materials from Mecklenburg County, which I guess would include court records and other things which you can talk about. I'm just curious as to what point we run out of room for all this, because do we have to keep everything forever?
We definitely don't keep everything. And that actually can be a disappointment to some people. The archival slice is fairly small. It tends to be about 5% of all of the records that are created because, you know, in North Carolina, everything that a government employee does is considered a public record. Mm-hmm. You can put in a public records request to any of our government offices, and they have to, within a reasonable amount of time, provide copies of what they've been working on as long as there are no confidentiality statutes. But you raise a very good point. We are running out of physical space. It's something that we have to think about and manage very carefully.
You have said that archives are participatory. You acknowledge a lot of power in being an archivist, but you say without the public participating, without agencies participating, the archive is not going to reflect the full history of North Carolina. And that full history involves people from all walks of life, minority groups. It requires trust because these people have to give you things to put in the archives, and they want to know that it's going to be properly handled, not disposed of, valued as they would have valued it. Yes. Is gaining that trust a challenge? Are some in certain communities less trustful of you because you're a government agency?
I think that's true. I think the fact that we're a government agency, it does sort of forestall some of those relationships. And honestly, you know, especially organizations that are engaged in civil disobedience or doing a lot of protesting are doing those kinds of activities. You know, it's it's a fact that a government archive might not be the place for their materials. A private archive has a lot more leeway to keep things closed, to protect people's identities and that kind of thing. Here, the materials that we bring in are the property of the public, which means that we have to provide access to it. There are very few situations in which we can close things. Usually that's by statute. So either federal statutes like FERPA and HIPAA, or there are a lot of confidentiality statutes in North Carolina state law that we follow. But and the fact is, I mean, what I mean by archives are participatory is that I think when you're when people think of these institutions, it's almost like it's automatic. There's some kind of mechanism running in the background that that makes all of these things happen at the state level. But really, the archive is created by a constellation of human decisions. So there is a lot of power. We have, our curatorial archivists who are also doing a lot of the processing and doing a lot of the describing of the archives. We do training, and this is part of the professionalization of the field. We do a lot of training on cultural competency and trying to think about our own personal experiences and biases. Most of the librarian community is made up of white women from a middle-class background. So the more diverse the population within the archive doing this archival work, the better, because we're not necessarily from these communities that we want to be collecting from. And that can be a stumbling block because we don't have quite the same frame of reference. So there are ways in which we know we are a little bit limited in those ways. We try to use our existing networks to broaden the community of folks that we are reaching with news about the archives with information about the services that we can provide. We also have a traveling archivist program that is designed to help folks who are keeping their own private archives get some of the information and the resources that they need to continue doing.
Let me stop you there. We have to take a break. Kelly Policelli, our guest. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking this morning to the North Carolina State Archivist in Raleigh, Kelly Policelli, who took the job beginning in December, but she has vast experience in that area. And we've been talking about preserving, essentially, history. That's what you do. You preserve North Carolina's history. And right now, you're the place that people go to do primary research, not secondary research. The actual documents are there. And there are political elements right now, particularly those within the Trump administration, who are actively working to whitewash our history, actively working to remove things that they find uncomfortable from the historical record. Is that a battle that you must fight?
So far, it has not touched us directly, in the sense that we have not been asked to do anything that we would not ethically feel comfortable with. Part of it is that we have a mission that is mandated in state law to collect the records of our state and local governments and to otherwise document the full history of North Carolina. So it has a chilling effect, I think, on most cultural resources organizations, just because we never know when that eye might fall on us. But from my perspective, it's my job to make sure that our archive does the best that it can at documenting the whole history of North Carolina. Well,
That's the job of people who run the Smithsonian and other organizations around the country that have already made changes at the behest of the Trump administration. They're trying to erase things like slavery, information about slavery or change the character of what slavery was. They're trying to erase the bad elements of Jim Crow and redlining and the treatment of indigenous peoples. And as a southern state that engaged in all of those activities, including taking land away from indigenous people, how is that information, how are those records handled by the state archives so that the integrity of what really happened remains?
We take this very seriously. It takes a lot of steps to remove something from the state archives. It is not something that anybody in this building would accept, I don't think. And that's what we're seeing across the board in libraries and archives is folks not necessarily taking this lying down. That's why you've seen firings happening and that kind of thing. What it takes is for the public to understand the value of archives and to advocate for maintaining the records.
Since you deal with this every single day, this is your life, your job. Let me get your impression of how history should be handled. Is an acknowledgement of the bad parts of our history somehow detrimental or divisive, or is it more of a way to better understand how to be better in the future?
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. I think it's hard for me to answer that question because I have a background in public history. To me, those are the interesting parts. How did we get through all of those, understanding the ways that our various storytelling has either kind of tried to smooth over some of those jagged edges of our history. I think it's the most interesting part. And I think hard histories are important if we're interested in becoming, like our documents say, a more perfect nation. I think that in and of itself is probably kind of, a political statement.
Are we losing the thread of who we are?
I think we're losing the thread of how we understand who we are, because without the kinds of things that we are maintaining here in the archives, what you're talking about is mythology and fiction. Are we going to accept that kind of thing, or are we actually going to seek out history in the sense of, are we going to tell stories that we can substantiate with evidence?
But evidence doesn't seem to always matter. We've done several shows in the past on this program about the rise of the Confederacy, and there is a segment of Americans, not just on this issue, but on many issues, that just have a problem or have difficult. Their grasp on reality is not necessarily the same as other people's grasp on the. There's a reluctance to accept certain truths because they don't comport with their worldview. And I'll get back to this secession argument, because in these programs that we've done, people keep saying, so there are a segment of people who say that secession was all about states' rights. It was not about slavery. And yet, when you show them that in the first paragraph of every article of secession from every state that seceded, slavery is mentioned as the reason for the separation, they don't see it.
Yeah. I wish I had an answer for you here. I really do. I think that's why it takes the folks who care about this, who want to make sure that we have this kind of evidence to embrace and protect institutions like the one I work for. I think that all of that, you can chalk it up to fear of what they would have to admit if they were to accept that. I think that as a historian, I would say, if you take slavery out of that equation, that war does not happen. So it's hard to make an argument that it didn't have anything to do with that. But that's in the weeds more than I think most people want to get. And the fact is, we know from studies of public history that people tend to trust their family, their parents, their grandparents more on matters of historical information than they do institutions like mine.
Well, there's an
And that's
attack.
where
There's a
trust
there,
comes in.
we are living through a constant attack on the truth in this country. Oh, the attacks on the media, attacks on experts, attacks on universities, attacks on people like you, ultimately, I'll bet you, because they're going after the Smithsonian and other preservation folks involved in preservation of our history. And they're trying to rewrite, they're telling us what we're looking at with our own eyes is simply not true, believe us, which is, has all the stamps of authoritarianism. You have said that George Floyd's murder a couple of years ago in Minneapolis, that after that there was an opening of understanding of what American history could be, and that archivists at your organization started thinking holistically about the stories they had been telling, how those stories had been framed. And that did happen across the country. There was this opening, and what we're witnessing now is a backlash to that. So, how do we find the truth in the historical record?
Well, that also, I mean, that right there is a tough question because the fact is, if you were to come in and take a look at the documentation we have on any event or issue in North Carolina, you would find in the documentation varying interpretations and holes in the record and places where you can't be sure of what you're reading. Every document, every piece of primary source material was created for a purpose and by someone who is usually trying to convince others of something. So, there's a long history in this country of debate. There's a long history of papering over certain parts of our history. I think you're right. And I tend to take a little bit more hope from the fact that we're seeing such a backlash right now and that so many people are like, no, this does not fly, because I do think that you can't turn back that what I consider progress on thinking about the whole experience of being an American, thinking about the ways that various communities have contributed to the American experiment. I love Black History Month, and I'm also super frustrated by it because, from my perspective, it marginalizes a history that is all of our history. It's you cannot understand the United States without understanding Black history. So I feel like, yes, we're seeing these pushes back on things that, by and large, Americans accept as part of American history. And I think the only way out is through, and we just have to keep doing our work and advocating and being willing to stand up and be brave about it. I think that that's obviously hard. These are people's, this is my job. I get paid to do this. I need it for, to take care of my family and to ensure our livelihoods and future. But at the same time, most librarians and archivists got into it because they have a passion for it, and they believe that primary sources are important. They need to be preserved.
And I know you've said that you haven't felt the kinds of pressure that perhaps is being exerted elsewhere on changing how our history is told, but you have also said that things have gotten, quote, a little more difficult. Maybe we can't use the same vocabulary because that's become controversial, but our core mission stays the same. Who's telling you that you can't use a certain vocabulary?
It's not necessarily a direct sort of prescription. It's more that we see what's happening out there, and I serve all of the people of North Carolina. So a good 50% of those people you know, have feelings about DEI that my field may not share. But, you know, we want to promote this work, maintain this work, keep all of our community connections, make sure that we are keeping our promises to groups that we have made connections with in the last 5 years, in a way that articulates that this is not, you know, this is not radical. This is just simply, having curiosity about what's going on in the state. And
we're really short on time here, and I want to talk about DEI because it is under attack. Trump and his cohorts have insisted that universities and corporations and other entities that receive federal funding, and you receive federal funding, abandon diversity, equity, and inclusion. But as a keeper of history, is that something you can really do? Can you keep an accurate collection of our history, past, present, and future, if DEI is not part of it?
So ultimately, we are responding to the questions that the people who come into our reading room and who contact us via email are asking us. Mm-hmm. And so as far as I'm concerned, if there are research questions that the people of North Carolina want to answer, I am going to try to make sure that we've got the documentation of that if it exists. We'll have to see what happens if that becomes an explicit expectation. We do have a little bit of federal funding. We don't have a lot of it. It actually has it's been, you know, to a certain extent frozen. I think the fact is that I kind of reject the premise. I think this is a diverse population. And if my job by law is to collect the history of this diverse population, then the collection that gets created should look diverse. You know, how far I'm willing to go to maintain that, I at this point feel like that's my job. And if I'm not allowed to do my job, then I have to do some hard thinking about whether or not I should be here. At this point, that has not really been something I've needed to think about.
So I have about 90 seconds left. The 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States is coming up on July the 4th. I know that you have some special things planned around that event. Give us a thumbnail of what you got, because I got about a minute left.
Yeah, so the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources has a huge calendar on their website of events around the state. There's been so much enthusiasm from county to county about this stuff. So there are county level events. The historic sites around North Carolina are all sort of chipping in with stuff. The State Archives is traveling two exhibits. We were calling them one day wonders. We bring them out to various places. We're going to be at Moores Creek very soon. We're going to be in Southport. We're going to be showing off the state constitutions and providing more information and some activities around the state constitutions. We also have a new exhibit on the soldiers' experience during the Revolutionary War that kind of pulls in all of the different folks who were active during that time, how they ended up joining the military and their experiences in the military during that time. We're going to be at the Azalea Festival down in Wilmington this year. We're going to have a exhibit probably at the Capitol sometime soon. So, you know, there's a lot going on. I highly recommend checking out the schedule because we could be in your neighborhood anytime now.
And people can and should access the archives. That's what they're there for, correct?
Absolutely. We're here to serve and we are open to the public. So anybody who has a question is interested in seeing a document, please come down and take a look.
Kelly, and so much more to talk about. We just didn't have time. Kelly Policelli is our guest, the North Carolina State Archivist. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you so much.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.